Southern California Chinese American Oral History Project, jointly sponsored by the UCLA Asian American Studies Center and the Chinese Historical Society of Southern California. This is the duplicate tape of Mrs. Lily Lam Chen's interview.
Tape two.
You ask me and then I'll talk about the laundry. Then
also fishing and canning industry.
Were these laundries outside the Chinatown area, and who were the landlords then? Did they have difficulties with these landlords?
No. If you pay money, you have no problem. See, they saw stores on Western and maybe Vernon, and one saw one elsewhere. They would go and ask the rental for the price of rental, and they say maybe $70 or too much, and then they have to go to look for a place that's $50 or maybe $39.50. So they don't have problem as long as they pay their rent. And the Chinese are not that bad like the other nationalities in trying to jip, you know, the rental, because they feel that if they have a place to do business, they don't feel like, you know, trying to cut down the rent as long. But they wish that they have more business, you know. And they're very nice to the clients, you know. And usually the people that send the laundry are upper middle class, you know, executives and people like that. And they talk nicely to them, spoken English. And then some of them would come back after they moved to another area to help them. That's why the laundry business is very, to them, it's something like seaman, gongzhuawa, you know, something that doesn't require a lot of hassle. You know.
So what would be considered a not seaman gongzhuawa?
Well, you'd be farming.
Farming?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And grocery, you know, hauling and things like that, you know, it's tough, you know.
So would you say people would, if they had a choice, they would prefer to be in laundry rather than in...
I think so. The uneducated, especially with the Western language, they prefer running laundry. They rather enlarge it later on into a larger wholesale type or something like that as the years go by. But I'm talking about the early days when individual laundries were being the main way of making a living. They have small ones.
How about restaurants? That's considered
same thing. The restaurants are about the same format. They have a small space. They have about 10 or more, you know, tables, or maybe 5-6 tables and one counter. And then the husband would do the learn how to cook anyway. No matter what they call it, a cook, you know, you know. And then chop, you know, fry the shrimps and then chop soy. And then the wife would wait on table. And then the son and daughter would come after school and do the cleaning up and all. Once in a while, they hire a Mexican to do the dishes in the rear. But that's the general is the format and the style they run. Until today, you know that the new style. Gradually, we're going to big enterprise.
The type you were just describing, that's a restaurant that's outside of Chinatown.
All over,
including the one.
Including in Chinatown, we have the Spring Street little small space and Marches South Street and all. This, before the Chinatown, near the Spanish Plaza was broken up. There are a lot of small restaurants and in Chinatown, elsewhere, and they always find a place near laundry, Chinese laundry, and then they don't go any other place. They see that there are customers coming into it, and usually it's single people, and people have a little means, otherwise they have to cook at home. They would come out, maybe the workers, the couples are workers, you know, job have professionals. So they flourish. They don't make a lot of money, but they are very frugal. And they have a lot of common sense. They know when not to spend, when to spend. And they can have 6 children where we can have 1 today without crying about a high cost of living. See, they know how.
I was wondering about the fishing and canning.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
the fishing and canning industry is mostly up Oregon way, cannery. The old timer who decided to go north on account of the salmon fishing especially, They live along Oregon Way, the different cities, I can't remember the name. But anyway, Ukiah is one of the area where people go fishing too. But then the cannery guys are the ones that manage the big canneries. They are not the owners. They're like a foreman, you call it today.
Chinese.
Yeah, they're good because they're honest, you know, and hardworking. So they control the Chinese laborer who do the cannery work, from fishing to canning, and you know, whatever process they go through. And they are supposed to be the wealthier ones,
no,
because they pay better.
Yeah, at that time in Los Angeles, were there such things as gong tao, you know, like if an American firm somewhere else wants to hire Chinese, like they would go to somebody in Chinatown and ask and they would go find
No, if you happen to know of a entrepreneur who has a big shop, and you're a friend of this man, he may hire you, you know. But there's no such a thing as going to the employment bureau and sizing up, you know, whom you can use as a foreman. The contacts were mostly mouth-by-mouth introduction or recommendation, you call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were not that spread out or socialized to be known, exposed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but once in a while, that there's some Americans or Westerners who are very friendly to some Chinese. Some of my students that my daddy used to, you know, be so close friend with so-and-so, who was a big shot, maybe Edison Company, a sub-chairman of something.
Was there any fishing down in Southern California, canning?
Canning, I don't think there was very much, mostly not frozen, but they were delivered fresh. Like San Francisco, you know, they have a tank, and then refrigeration came in, you know, not in Alaska.
So
there are some that go fishing and quietly sell it to the restaurant, and it's against the law now. They do.
Oh, you mean the Chinese would do it on their own,
oh,
fish
yeah.
down here and
yeah,
sell it?
Not the large scale that I remember.
Mostly Chinese restaurants.
Yeah, yeah, because they can use it up. You know, whatever the individual ships, I mean, boat can get in, how many pounds is, say, a whole basket. See, they quietly give it up to the different restaurant. And they can consume and use it, you know.
No.
But up north is where the big scale is, you know. They have a real factory, they call it cannery worker. And they make better money.
Mm-hmm.
They're wealthier.
Now, someone was just fresh off the boat from Tongsan.
Yeah.
And he was looking for a job.
Mm.
You know, where would he go?
He would likely go to do a house job. If you can't speak English, so they...
Mm.
But then how does he find the Sayan?
Well, this Sayan, there were times in the newspaper they wanted, or somebody already working in such a job, and the boss, the boss of this particular Chinese know the boss of another family, and recommend, you know, them. I know boss Mr. Jones of Clay Jones' apartment or that area of Russian Hill wants a cook, you know, and then if he doesn't know how he'll, the Chinese would tell him what kind of cooking expected of him, fry eggs and make some bacon, you know, and simple cooking. Any Chinese can learn that. And then the only thing they have to learn is how to bake muffins, you know, and it's the hardest is baking muffins. You have to throw a lot away before they become, you know, edible. And they have experience like that. They have to throw away, but they don't never charge you for the waste. You just, you know, hide it and throw it in the waste basket. You know,
yeah.
If you show it to them, they know you're not proficient. There was an experienced person that told me that they expect him to make muffins. He said, muffin, I'm what la? This kind of that. Your muffin is a little between cake and what you call. So they have their problem, but they learn, the Chinese, once they learn, they don't let them go, the boss.
For this kind of job, did they also have employment agencies in the Chinatown? I know in San Francisco they did.
Well, they not in Los Angeles, maybe there's one that's trying. It was very rare, very rare. Usually they can read the San Francisco paper. And then before there were no Chinese papers here. In the beginning, it was all from San Francisco. You know, Saigapo, Zhongsaiapo, Kamsansipo, you know. So everything, they come the same day. They arrive at the same day, you know, maybe later in the afternoon. But it's very interesting. They really have a tough time, you know.
Now, what about working for other Chinese? For example, did some Yap people prefer to hire their Tohung and, you know, hire other Sam Yap?
There's a tendency. The Chinese
people
are very clannish. I must say that. Even with the Guangdong Yan, Cantonese, you know, if you are Guangdong, but now because they have not enough people to choose from, so the first thing is that, are you from the same area, you know, same district? Or, all right, the Heung San likes to keep all the Heung San in their job, and the Thoi San, and San Mui, and Gong Zhao, and whatever the district or regional differentiations. But yeah, there's a tendency.
So is there some kinds of jobs where you find more Sam Yap Yan and some kinds of jobs where you find more Se Yap Yan?
Oh, huh? Se Yap Yan, they mostly go into restaurant business, mostly. Heung San is in dry goods. Because I mean, the Chengming deal is not so dirty, you know. my cigar and shirts and silk handkerchief from China fans, you know, something like you would call a little boutique, you know, old fashioned boutique. Could I come? And then they say, and the young year to go. Gantin, the Joe, they say, yeah, because they're a little bit more simple minded, but they're very warm. They're warm. No, I don't mean everybody is, everybody, but because they come from the village and they're not exposed to the city life, and they're very naive, I would say, more naive, you know. The Heung San Yan, in their own village, they already built up a little ahead of the other villages. That's why this is exposure.
What about Sam
Yan? Sam Yan, intelligent, very selective too. I think they're mostly in, in a little cleaner type of merchandising.
Was it because in their families and Sam Yap already were in?
Yeah, some of them, yeah. Some of them have been my cigar or my name in for two generations. And I remember stationery stores, things like that, which is a tidier business, you know. We don't have perishability. And then some of them go into some grocery, but the sale, small restaurants. Of course, they do something else too, one or two, but I'm talking about them at large, you know, the majority of them are in that sort of business, occupation.
Now, do any of these businesses cater to non-whites, but not Chinese, I mean, you know, like Mexicans or blacks? Or
oh, yes, they can. Anybody can come and patronize them. We're not discriminative.
Oh, no, but I mean, is there, do a lot of non-whites come to, like, the Chinese restaurants in that day?
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
Until 1930, let me think now. Latter part of 1938, in Los Angeles, I witnessed a change there, and that I have to tell you a story. See, everybody thinks the Japanese and Chinese eat the same thing or the same habits, you know. But we know that the Chinese, of course, the Chinese want to say that we are the big sister and the big brother of the Asian heritage back there. So, during the war, there was so much misunderstanding concerning the Japanese and China that people don't know which side to rally for. So we decided that a group of other people, especially American folks, decided to have an organization called the Chinese Culture Society in the beginning, to have a monthly meeting, get somebody to talk about Chinese culture, and meantime give them a nice dinner for $1.50, you know, and have Chinese food, and then kind of educate them to know more about China and Japan and the difference and all that sort of thing. But so it had gone on until now, even some of them are carrying the same work. The reason I bring this point out is that was the beginning where the Chinese people attract the white people into our territory and patronize us, buy things as a gift. Of course, they buy gifts anyway, once in a while before. But because they're in Chinatown after a nice meal, they're happy, you know, they could run around Chinatown and patronize our other merchants. So that was, I think to me, as far as my observation is concerned, was the latter part of 38, just before the New Life Movement was organized, officially. And then they come to Chinatown and they like it. For 50 cents, 75 cents, they have a nice Chinese luncheon. With the jaha, you know, and chop suey and things like that,
for
50 cents only, and they think it's a wonderful deal. So then they came before you now. We flooded with American, but
what did most of the people in Chinatown do, like when they have free time?
I can't say that in general. There are categories that like to sit around with their old friends and play poker and play mahjong throughout, you know. And you can't blame them because they don't dance, they don't play golf, and they don't go out to do, you know, civic things that keep them busy so that they don't have time to sit down. Like me, I have no time to play mahjong. I know how to play it, but I'm not good. But then my friends, when they're lucky, they marry a husband that, you know, they have enough income, they want to take it easy. Well, that's their privilege and their joy. And then you have some of that join the American throne and go out and play golf, you know. They want to play just as good, and pretty soon they know their Western friends, and then they drag them into their clubhouse, the Hillcrest, Jewish Club, or whatever, Pasadena. And then you have some that like to go fishing, like all the rest of the American, you know, pastimes.
But like the restaurant and laundry workers, by the time they get off, it's so late at night, what would they be doing?
They would go to a place where they can have a drink and maybe see a few girl show if they were not the family type, or they would go to another mahjong session and play for a few rounds and go home. Or they would gang up themselves in a certain place where one of the workers have a better apartment, you know, and get together and enjoy themselves and strengthen their ties that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they like that kind of
pleasure. Were there many like regular established like gambling dens in Chinatown?
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, not officially that I know, but let me tell you. But I tell you, there were some all through the years. Let me tell you honestly. See, these organizations, 10 or 15 organizations, whatever the names be.
You mean the Zhongcanso and
Zhongcanso, the different Gongxiangbui, Tonghuangbui, and all that. They always have a perpetual game going on, in the sense that even the women, the wives, they play games. Maybe they have a little money involved in it. I don't know. I never go into inquire. But they have a very good time playing mahjong throughout the night and you know, winning from each other and have a good time. Now, some of them, they're not playing for a winner, for the winning. They would play and put the money in a jackpot or something, and then they would go dancing or take, you know, dinner, everybody participated. So there are all kinds of, you know, the way that they do gamble. But I shouldn't call that word gamble, because it's gaming, or whatever you call it, playing games, you see. Bingo, like, it's officially, you know, not legal now, it's illegal. So I want to make sure that I don't accuse these people for, you know, for playing the games that they like to, because they don't play golf and they don't dance like I do. I can go to a ballroom and spend the whole night and I forget about the sitting down and play mahjong, see. But some of them, they don't do that. But then there are a lot of them now, today. They are taking the children to these cultural things, you know, participating in a civic, you know, the operas and shows and the music center, the Schubert Theater and all that. Now, this is a generation that is a little different.
But
before, in San Francisco, they had opera, Chinese opera from China.
Yeah.
Did they have it down here too?
Yeah, we had very few. We have to borrow them and pay a lot of money, oh, thousands of dollars. It's just like drinking water in the desert, you know, when they come down.
Was there a theater here for Chinese opera?
Oh, we rented one.
All right.
So we don't have a theater. But up north, you touch a thing that I can tell you. In the olden times, when my father was a young man, you know, they have operas all the time, very like the way we go to this Italian operas, you know, the Barbara Seville and things like that. They have a standard, you know, shows going on. And did you know, if you can wait till 10 o'clock, you know, after the show starts 2 hours, if you know the ticket collector, you can go around the back there and squeeze into a seat. My father used to do that, he told me, you know, and then enjoy, and he enjoys the singing, and also because he's a little different from the rest of his contemporaries. So they had up north, but not down here, until very recently. Today we don't have a regular opera, we have movies, movie houses only. But today, if they came, we have movie houses to accommodate them.
So do you mean that in the early days that most Chinese in Chinatown did not like to see movies?
Oh, no, not that they don't like to. They haven't got the time, and there's no proximity. See, if they have to go to... Did you know that the old folk used to wear the Chinese clothing and the Chinese slippers, and they just walk around Chinatown and leisurely, just like today they're doing now. They used to laugh at us for having pantaloons. You know, they're going back to our original style. Well, they just don't go down beyond you know, the limit street, you know. They don't go beyond Kearney Street in San Francisco, nor Powell Street in San Francisco. Here, I guess they don't go down to, what street is the nearest that they don't want to go beyond? Anyway, they don't go beyond Sunset, no, even La Cosa, you know, maybe Ord would be. Between Ord and whatever the... even Bernard was a little far away. See, they were only a little sort of section, you know, rectangular section. They know each other. If they have to go through the tunnel, it's just a few blocks away, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, about what percentage of the Chinese here had families and what percent were like?
You mean how many? I can't give you the percentage.
Oh, no, I mean about, you know, like, would you say
have families?
More than? Yeah, because you mentioned that, you know, like sometimes some of the men didn't have families, so they had different kinds of recreation.
Oh, those are the bachelor that came over here or lost
their
spouses. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the majority, more than 50%, have families.
Have families.
The Chinese are family-oriented.
And did their
one
spouses,
or two, they have it.
Did they get married in China and bring their spouses here, or they worked here for a while and went back to China, you know? Look for a wife in China and then bring the wife back.
Way back in the 30s and 20s and beyond or earlier, they usually go back to China and find a wife because it's hard for them to cope with the native born women. And at the same time, they would find somebody from their own heritage, background, meaning from the same village, speak the same language and sympathize with him, you know, sympathetic with his ways and manners and tradition. And then as, by recommendation, I'm as a from friends from the village, say, I have a nice girl, and this one, so, you know, Muyan recommended, and they see each other. They are not blind, you know, folded to marry. They know of the background. In fact, sometimes it's a little happier than the one that they come into on the street here, you know.
Well, on the subject, can you tell us how you met your husband?
Oh, is that important?
Yeah.
My husband came over to got to work for his doctorate at Stanford. Her brother, Dr. Chen, S.Y. Chen, who just passed on, was at Chicago University, just got his Ph.D. And when he knew that Stanley, my husband, was coming over, he recommended him to stay in San Francisco and see the Chinese community a bit before he goes to Chicago. So he did. Before he could make his first move, his classmate from Lingnan University asked him to stay. He said, this is a better ground for you to develop, and why don't you go to Stanford instead of Chicago University, just as a qualify for your work at political science. So he hovered around a little bit. And then he went to UC for summer school. I was a freshman or something like that. And he was standing in line looking for the queue, you know. I said, mister, I said, how are you looking for, you know, the application line? You know how California is just here. Huge, you know. He said, yes. And I said, this is the line. And instead of asking him to stand in the rear, that being a foreign student, I said, you stand in front of me, pretending that we came together. That was the first time I talked to him, you know, I don't know him. Before I knew it, he was in the same language group, because the friend of his told him to stay on and make him the dean of the Chinese language school there, you know, which is nothing, you know, just you teach the upper grade, that's all, you know, the Hawa. And so he taught there, I taught there. And we were just, you know, co-workers for a long time, for a couple of years. And then later on, my mother died. And I wanted to bring my younger brother and sister back to China to study. And somehow in my mind, I said, maybe I can't be an old maid this long. I wanted to, you know, teach you. And I wasn't thinking of marriage. And it developed to a good friendship. And when my mother was very ill, he knew about it. He went to visit my mother at Clay Jones' apartment in San Francisco, up on the hill there, because my mother had the heart ailment. My father was working for the Chinese Times, and he didn't want to go back to the Peters Avenue home, which is about half an hour, you know, from Chinatown. So, you know, everything just kind of developed, and I guess he became very close to my mother and family. And I observed him as a kid. I said, I guess 20 years from now, you'll still be a pretty good boy, you know. I said, I'll become friends. And we go, then he dated me to go to different things. I go sometimes. I don't often go. I went with him, you know, a few times. And then we became very understanding because I was teaching, he was teaching. And when I was teaching, I had to play the piano and sing these songs, hymns, before we go to class. It's a religious school, you know. We have to sing one hymn and say a prayer. And he used to supervise and everything. So we just became friends. And before I knew it, then I decided that if he went back to China to teach, that I would go back and teach too. So we just got married after a few years. And I sent for my brothers and sister, my brother and sister to go back to Peking, where we lived together. And they go to school in the daytime, I mean in the weekdays, and come back. And we had a very, very good time. And we bring Westernization into the Peking students who were Trujillo, you know, they kind of think that they know it all, you know, kind of stiff, you know. And so I give dances in my patio with a talcum powder on the tile floor. And then I buy bunches of potatoes and baked potatoes, you know, French potatoes for them, and mix salad for them. And they say they like it better than tea they eat all through their life. And they say, when your sister going to give another party? You see, that is international relations, eh? And so we had a wonderful time. My brother and I really did a lot of public relations for the Toji Jai. They used to think that, well, Arthur and so is from Singapore, and they all Wakyu. Yeah, Wakyu, Waksangwa. They're good, they're smart sportsmen, but they're maybe not too, what you call, deep, you know. But Arthur turned out to be pretty good because he fell in line with the stream over there, so did I. So that's how we spent
the... So the parents did not play much of a role?
With me? Oh, no. I think no, I didn't, they don't have to. By the time 1930-something, you know, 33.
So you were married in
33 July. At that time, of course, you must understand my family is a little bit more ahead. See, my father's quite ahead of the YQ, was it? And but then the other people, they still have a lot of restriction. You can't go out, you know. And
so you wouldn't say your case was typical
of the old-fashioned
in your class?
No, not purely, just semi, not quite typical. But I have girlfriends that are very wealthy, but their family was very, very dogmatic about things, you know, the things that you know about, you know, very old-fashioned, and you're not supposed to, you know, go out with a boy and more than so many, you know, hours, you know, you come home by midnight and you're not going to go alone, your sister got to go along.
So would their parents in America ever try to arrange marriages the way they would in China?
Oh, yes.
They
still did in the 19s, you know, around the early turn of the 20th century, they still arrange. And they're good, sometimes very good, you know, because I know you and you know me, you got a son, I got a daughter, and then you just indirectly, like they all know each other, and then you reinforce it, then it became, you know, materialized.
Now, as you mentioned, you said, like, quite a number of people, like, they got married in China, or their spouses, you know, they and their spouse both came from China, and then they had children here. So, if they were thinking of Fan Tong San to retire, what would they think that their children would do? Would they plan to bring their children back with them back to Tong San, or
not necessarily for good? They might like to take them back to the village and take a look see, because the children would not naturally like to settle down there, unless there happened to be one exception that a daughter, see, I like it here so much, Mom, I'm gonna stay with you, or something like that. But they usually like to bring them home and stick them in and put them into a Chinese language school and learn the Chinese culture. A couple of years they come home, but that would be the time before they can have a chance to have their own minds. They have to be, you know, still under their supervision. See, they bring a lot of students back to China, you know. They go back there, they place them, the wealthier would place them in a city school like Lingnan, Puijing, you know, whatever, Puidou, and Nanbo and all those schools. And then the Lingnan would be, Zhang Guang would be the more exclusive, the more advanced, you know, well-to-doers. But the others, they place them in Nikokujo, Taiwan Mianlui Hao, Taiwan, you know, Zhonghok or something like that. And they study, they get some Chinese, and it's good. They come back a little bit more filial and understanding and not so snobbish about anything Chinese. It helps a lot of them.
Did they bring the son only back for education, or also the daughter?
Mainly, they like to have the son first. And if they happen to one daughter and a girl, you know, a boy and a girl, they would both be. Now I'm not talking about every family. Some of the families is financially distressed or too stingy for educating a girl, because a girl is going to get married and go out of family. But those ideas are still in some of the mind. But most of them are a little more advanced in thinking. They would say, well, no, that's the way they talk, you know, say that wow. And meaning that I would like to send my children back to China and let them imbibe, you know, instill into them some Chinese culture, and so that they will have a more balanced life, which is a normal thing. The Germans do that. Mm-hmm. The Scotch do that.
So for the ones
the Dutch do that.
For the ones who couldn't afford to